I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. Many Americans have their own idea of what military service is, and we get that image or idea from movies, novels, and other pop culture references. But our reality of military service is getting further and further away from the truth as fewer people join the armed forces. For context, over the past half of century, the number of people on active duty has dropped significantly from 3.5 million in 1968 to about 1.4 million, or less than 1% of all U.S. adults. Now, some of that is attributed to today's all-volunteer force. So today on the show, we're going to walk through some of the national issues affecting veterans, like the VA healthcare system, how we treat veterans when they come home, access to education, and what the future of military service looks like. We'll also touch on some aspects of veteran life with unique Vermont roots. But first, we're going to welcome Jasper Craven, one of the authors of the new book, Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies of the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. The two other authors are Suzanne Gordon and Steve Early. Jasper, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So Jasper, I want to start with where you get your sense of responsibility when it comes to veterans affairs. It's like, how did you end up on this beat?
Well, actually, the summer of 2014, I was in college and I was in Washington stringing for the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus, two Vermont newspapers. I was there to cover Vermont's congressional delegation, and Bernie Sanders at the time was chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. This was as he was sort of contemplating his first run for president, but not a lot of people were paying much attention to him. He was sort of the gadfly in Washington, you know, walking around with his hair sticking up and, you know, sort of picking his pet projects and railing for them. But I was in a lot of committee hearings that he was running that focused on the incredibly generous social safety net that veterans enjoy. This was something that Bernie had been supporting and trying to strengthen for years. And during that summer, 2014, there was this incredible scandal that blew up. Basically, Bernie's counterpart in the House, a Republican named Jeff Miller, who was a tan former Florida weatherman, started making all of these allegations saying that veterans were dying at a veterans hospital in Phoenix because administrators were essentially cooking the books on wait times and veterans were languishing and unable to access care. This essentially turned out to be a overstated and largely incorrect sort of political hit job that seemed pretty well sort of placed ahead of the 2014 midterms. And Bernie did a lot of work trying to defend the VA system amid these largely baseless attacks. Inevitably, he worked with John McCain on legislation called the VA Choice Act, which essentially was a compromise measure in which Bernie got some more money to better staff the VA and put resources into the VA. McCain, on the other hand, managed to secure language that allowed veterans to seek more outside privatized healthcare choices if they needed it. So I was sort of there witnessing all of that happening and sort of saw from my interactions with Bernie and his staff how incredible and wide-ranging the VA is.
So as a young journalist, like, you've just kind of got thrown into this topic.
Yeah. I mean, it was an incredible experience. I mean, I was in, you know, a room with Bernie and his people talking about the VA, and it became very clear that Bernie sees the VA as proof of concept of so many of his signature policy issues. You know, I mean, veterans enjoy free college. They enjoy government-run socialized medicine, healthcare. You know, the VA has incredible housing programs, low-interest home loans. And so I think what Bernie was trying to do there is protect these programs and show that some of them could be translated and undertaken for a civilian population.
You talked about this. You touched on this just a little bit ago. But how do you describe the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and what's its role in society today?
It's an incredibly sprawling agency. I mean, it's the second largest agency to the Defense Department, and it's grown significantly over the years thanks to intense advocacy by veterans groups who have fought and won benefits and supports for transitioning veterans. But essentially, the role, broadly speaking, for the VA is to help returning service members, transition back into a civilian life that they may be very unfamiliar with. Obviously, war and military service is so foreign to the day-to-day experiences that so many of us enjoy, and so it can be really difficult to, settle back into that world. And the VA tries to help ease that transition.
Now, in 2018, you did several stories with VT Digger where you highlighted the toxic culture of the Vermont Air Force Air National Guard. Will you tell us about that? And I also understand you have a story out today that's kind of a continuation of that story. So let's talk about what that story was and how it's evolved over the years.
Sure. Well, I think that there has been incredible tension in recent decades as the military has diversified. I mean, we've seen women in combat roles now for about a decade. That happened in 2013, and I think there are unique challenges when women and other minority groups enter a system that has been dominated mostly by white men for so long. And this has played out pretty perniciously at the Vermont Air and Army National Guard. My 2018 series, seven-part series, focused in on a series of allegations of sexual misconduct and sort of a hard-charging, partying, drinking atmosphere within the Air Guard among the fighter pilots that was really not reined in. These guys sort of had power. They had buddies. There was sort of this good old boy network that flourished. And it was incredibly difficult for women to move up the ranks, to report misbehavior without facing retaliation. And, after that series came out, there was an assessment done from an outside guard agency called the Office of Complex Investigations. Lawmakers pledged reforms. There has been a lot of work done and new policies implemented to make the Guard a safer place for women, especially. However, just today I released a story about one of the Guard's golden boys, a man named Zach Fike, who's been in the organization for a long time. And our reporting at VT Digger suggests that he has been the subject of sexual misconduct allegations dating back to 2014. And many people are worried now that there is an investigation into Fike that he may be treated with kid gloves. And they're worried that they may not see justice and Fike may be able to skirt real punishment.
So is the overall answer that the Vermont National Guard has not gotten better? It's gotten incrementally better? Where are we today?
It's really difficult to understand exactly where things stand because the organization is incredibly secretive and there's a lot that the Guard's leadership is prevented from discussing. However, last year I wrote a story about another Guard member who had racked up a series of incredibly serious felony charges across Vermont for, behavior up into and including violent rape, and he was allowed to stay in the Guard. The Guard only punished him and booted him after my reporting came to light. I think the Adjutant General, Greg Knight, has really taken initiative to try to make the place more welcoming, to have an open-door policy, to say that, if misbehavior is spotted, it will be immediately dealt with. But it's an incredibly entrenched organization, and I think it's hard for him to always know what's going on because I think there's still a lot of fear of retaliation, even if he has made some policy changes to improve the culture.
Now, Jasper, when writing this new book, Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs, what were the big takeaways that you want to make sure people have?
I think that there's a deep and abiding public perception of veterans as either sort of wholly damaged population or as one that is sort of protected and able to thrive post-military service because of sort of the leadership skills that they've gleaned through Pentagon service. I think what the book is trying to do is offer a bit of a corrective and show that the state of Veterans Affairs today is the positive state, I should say, is in jeopardy. There are a lot of forces now that are seeking to undermine the strong social safety net that veterans have built over many decades. And, you know, this plays out across healthcare, education, benefits, all of these things. As the veteran population has shrunk, groups like the American Legion and the VFW, which, you know, have generally the best interest of veterans at heart and could lobby for positive policy developments, have lost power. And in that vacuum, what we've seen is a lot of ideological astroturf groups come in, as well as corporate healthcare groups and other sort of for-profit entities that are seeking to sort of build a sort of economy similar to the military-industrial complex, but for veterans. Essentially, they want their piece of the pie, and they want to profit off the backs of veterans.
And what surprised you the most in this book?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, as a civilian coming into veteran life, there's just so much that's foreign to you. I mean, there's so much jargon and unique experiences that you just don't have. And so I sort of constantly find myself surprised and curious about what life looks like for veterans. I mean, I was really taken aback initially, just to see in 2014 when I was covering the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee how politics around veterans policy had degraded so much. I think there's still a lot of sort of news headlines that trumpet veterans policy making as like one of the last bipartisan issue areas. But when you really zero in, there's a lot of shady stuff going on. I mean, there are a lot of special interests that are donating to lawmakers on these committees who want contracts. You know, I mean, one interesting example is there is this entire industry now that offers basically snake oil PTSD treatments to veterans. So they have successfully lobbied lawmakers for pilot programs in which veterans with serious PTSD are placed in programs that are, you know, gimmicky and don't actually have any efficacy behind them. One of the more famous ones was in Houston, Texas, which was basically this treatment that was just a chair on an axis swivel that, you know, flung a veteran around and was supposed to create positive neurological benefits, but it was a total scam. There was nothing behind it. There was no science. And so just to see interests act so so sort of greedily around veterans who have sacrificed so much was very surprising to me.
We're going to get to some of that in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about Vermont's role when it comes to the National Guard. Vermont is an unusual state when it comes to veterans and military service. We don't have a ton of military opportunities, but the Vermont National Guard has a deep history going back to the Green Mountain Boys. We also have Senator Bernie Sanders, as you said earlier, playing a big role in Veterans Affairs because he sits on the VA committee. So how does his role shape post-active duty life for people, and what's the role that the Green Mountain Boys play nationally when it comes to the National Guard and our armed services?
Yeah, no, I mean, Vermont's role militarily is a very interesting one. And, you know, Bernie, I think, has really carved out a specific policy position that is generally oppose the war, support the soldier. So you've seen, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of really strong advocacy from Bernie to, you know, enhance dental benefits for veterans, to get more clinical staff inside the White River Junction VA and other hospitals, to Bernie managed also to set up really pioneering family support programs in the Vermont National Guard that include free childcare. Bernie has also, you know, helped make the Green Mountain Boys greener through, you know, solar arrays and things like that. So Bernie sort of works within the military system. He supported the F-35, which was perhaps his most controversial move. But, you know, he sees the economic benefits of military service. He and I think he has not opposed the military in Vermont because of that. He sees the free college. He sees the free health care. You know, Senator Leahy, also a major supporter of the National Guard and the Green Mountain Boys. He was also critical in securing the F-35 fighter jets in Burlington, which, that was the first Air Guard unit in the country to get those planes. So the Green Mountain Boys have a very prestigious reputation in America. And of course, dating back to Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, who are these mythical figures who really help sort of shaped Vermont's core identity. They demanded independence. They fought off New York attempts to sort of take them over. They captured Fort Ticonderoga during the Revolutionary War. And so I think there is a deep and abiding respect for the Guard, and much of that, is well learned. I mean, we saw the Guard, for instance, during COVID, set up field hospitals and figure out vaccine delivery and offer food to families in need. So there is a role, and also during Tropical Storm Irene, the Guard also played a really important role in sort of shoring up infrastructure and helping out. So they've had a mixed role in the state over
there. Very big role. Let's go to the phones and let's talk to Kay in Williamstown. Kay, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello. I just wanted to report that my father was in Strategic Air Command. My husband was a military intelligence specialist. Both of them were veterans, one my father from World War II, my husband from the Korean War, and he was 100% disabled veteran. He moved back to Vermont. I receive from Williamstown $40,000 off the value of my home for tax purposes, which is a good benefit. My husband and my father were treated very well by the VA systems. I had an opportunity to have Bernie Sanders check into my widow's pension that I got from being the caregiver of my husband for his last years of his life. And I was always very pleased with everything. I now receive my medication free from the CHAMP VA program.
Okay, thank you so much for that call. I'm sorry we cut you off, but we do have to get to break. But I do so much appreciate you calling and sharing your experience about all the benefits that you have received from your husband. Now, Jasper, I will get to you, but I do want to go to some of these phone calls. Let's start with Brian in Chittenden County. Brian, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your question or comment?
Well, it's a little multifaceted. I'll try and be as brief as possible.
Thank you.
I think Jasper, you're speaking to a lot in a very short period of time. I don't disagree that the VA healthcare system and really the military are socialized systems inherently. I don't think that they're currently working as efficiently or as positively as being described. Yes, there are housing programs. Yes, there are disability programs. But very few veterans are instructed on how to navigate these systems and garner that support. I'm a social worker today because I had a clinician, when I'm describing how I was acutely suicidal after I got back from Iraq, leaves the room to take a call from a family member. These problems exist, and these problems are not necessarily always attended to. And I think where I'm struggling a little bit is listening to someone who is not a veteran speak about the culture and the climate and how the military, both in Vermont and outside, work. Because plainly, veterans, we're not allowed to talk to the media. It is not secretive by nature. It is just a consequence of our responsibility to exist outside of partisan politics and conduct ourselves ethically. I think what I struggle with so often is veterans, we're a different cultural group. We have a different cultural experience that isn't necessarily understood by civilians. And when civilians project onto us identity and utilize us as a catalyst or a point of leverage to make change or to politicize what we do, it's deeply disingenuous to our experience and very difficult.
Brian, certainly can understand the frustration you're feeling. But I do want to take some of that criticism to you, Jasper, as somebody with no military experience who is talking about these issues. How do you leverage not being part of a community and yet reporting on and with that community accurately?
Yeah, no, it's a challenge. And I hear that comment, and it's something that I have been acutely aware of in the 5 years that I've been covering veterans' issues and the military. I mean, first, I just do want to address the criticism of the VA. You know, I admit that the VA is far from perfect, and I've spoken to vets who've had really major struggles with the VA, trying to get into the VA, trying to navigate the morass of paperwork, the arcane requirements to just get in the front door and get some help. So I can acknowledge that there are problems with the system. What I think is sometimes overlooked is that the VA, while imperfect, performs far better than the private sector on virtually every single metric, whether that's wait times, whether that's cost, whether that's quality. The VA runs an integrated healthcare system where your heart doc is talking to a nutritionist who's talking to a mental health professional. The VA developed the nicotine patch, the shingles vaccine, the best mental health care treatments on the market. And these are imperfect, of course. I mean, the VA has a major struggle to deal with people returning from service that can be incredibly damaging. I mean, right now they're having to gear up to help millions of veterans who were sickened in their time overseas from burn pits that the Pentagon used in violation of, you know, core OSHA rules and basic common sense. That have made people, including Vermont Guardsmen, sick with cancer, and many of them have died. I do not pretend to speak to all veterans. It's an incredibly diverse population, and I'm not, I don't claim to do that. But I can tell you that I have spoken to hundreds and hundreds of veterans over the years from all walks of life, from officers to the enlisted. And basically what my mission is to do is to reflect their concerns and serve as a vehicle for them to be heard. So, I admit that that's imperfect, and I admit that I'm a civilian. But I also think that coming to this world with some fresh eyes can be helpful because, you know, I've spoken to veterans who, in conversations will discuss something, some element of the culture, and sort of in the conversation with a civilian, it will sort of dawn on them that it's, you know, there's something wrong there or something that they maybe took for granted as normal that they should perhaps have questioned in the moment. So I try to listen as much as I can, but, you know, I admit I'm not perfect.
So speaking about, you know, VA healthcare and all the things that they do, the White River Junction VA has a nationally recognized doctor in charge of their PTSD center, Dr. Matthew Friedman. This guy essentially put PTSD on the map medically. Will you just give us a little insight into who this person is that lives right here in our state?
Yeah, no, Vermont actually has a very noble history when it comes to pioneering VA programs in PTSD. This guy, Matt Friedman, moved to Vermont right after the Vietnam War, and he actually married a Vietnam combat medic named Gail Smith. They lived in Williston back when it wasn't, you know, a bunch of malls. It was just some cow fields. And Gail, you know, started talking about her experiences and the trauma that she endured as a combat medic in Vietnam. Matt was a young psychologist, and he became interested in trying to better understand some of these mental issues. You know, PTSD went by many names before it actually was recognized, like soldier's heart during World War I, for instance. And so basically Gail and Matt started interviewing vets, hundreds of them, in their tiny little house in Williston, trying to understand some common symptoms. That actually paved the way in 1980 for the official recognition of PTSD. And then after that, Friedman led a massive survey of 500,000 veterans across the country to better understand the causes of PTSD, the symptoms, and then from there help develop a number of evidence-based mental health care treatments for it.
Now, I want to talk about a chapter in the book that I thought was extremely eye-opening and sad, which was this concept of stolen valor. Valor. Sorry. Will you tell us a little bit about that and just the concept as you see it in the context of your book?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's sort of a long history of people often in political roles who either inflate or completely fabricate military service in order to, you know, accrue some of the goodwill and positive reputational benefits of that. We've seen a number of politicians, you know, sort of maneuver in that world forever. I think what we're also seeing now is corporations and other actors try and sort of hug veterans and identify with them in order to receive those positive reputational benefits. I think a good example is Amazon, for instance. Amazon has an incredibly rich hiring program for veterans. It runs a lot of ads about how it hires veterans and supports the troops and, you know, loves the flag and these sorts of things. And, you know, some of the vets who are hired on at Amazon are in senior positions. Many of them are former officers and they're paid very well and they find meaning in their work. But many more are, you know, shuffled into warehouses and you know, undergo incredibly grueling working conditions. They're not paid well. Some of them have to rely on their VA benefits for health care and other support because working conditions at Amazon can be so terrible. And so in the book, we explore a number of instances where corporations and other entities sort of cynically embrace veterans while in reality aren't treating them that well.
And, you know, in the book, you also talk about some of these nonprofit organizations that, for lack of a better word, are disingenuous in their mission, or maybe their mission isn't fully realized because people get greedy. I'm thinking of the Wounded Warriors Project. In 2016, they found out that they were only giving 60% of their revenues to vets, and the remaining 40% went to overhead. In the book, it kind of not goes into too much detail, but talks about how, you know, some of that went to like lavish trips and other, you know, expensive, high paid executives. What does that do for the psyche of the veterans that you have spoken to?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think what that shows is that there is a lot of genuine goodwill from the American public towards the veteran community. I think people really want to support this population and recognize the sacrifices that they've made. However, there have been an explosion of veteran focused nonprofits over the last two decades, you know, more than 11,000, and there's so little regulation over these charities that many of them have, again, you know, projected this incredibly positive image, promised really sweeping things to help this community. But then, you know, once reporters have started digging, it turns out that veterans are actually, you know, sort of not receiving the services that have been promised, while officials at the top are making incredibly, you know, luxurious salaries and using the money for more improper means.
Let's go to John and Sharon. John, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for getting me on. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. Gail Smith and I actually, before Matt and Gail became a couple and started going down that road, founded the first off-campus, off VA campus veterans group in the Upper Valley and probably in most of Vermont and Hampshire. Gail and Matt never lived in Williston. I don't know where you got that. And by the way, Matt Friedman is an MD, PhD. He, you know, he's got a regular MD from Dartmouth and also a PhD in biochemistry. He's not a psychologist.
I think we said that. I think we said White River Junction and not Williston.
No, I said Williston. I thought he had told me that. He said Cowfield, but maybe I'm wrong. You know him better than I do.
Yeah. No, he lived in Plainfield, New Hampshire, and he still, you know, that's where he had his house for many years. Gail and he set up housekeeping in Woodstock, which is where they live now. But point is, more importantly, Gail and I and many others were working with veterans who would not go to the VA. And the sad truth is that even today, over 50% of Vietnam veterans, and this is true of World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, won't set foot on government property to get their health care. And that's the sad reality of things. So we still work, I still work, through an organization called Winter Center, based in Norwich and Wilder, to work with all those veterans who cannot stand the thought of going to the government for anything. As good as, by the way, the health care is, and I agree with Jasper that it's extraordinarily good system.
John, while we have you on the line, what do you attribute that to? I mean, as somebody who doesn't have a lot of familiarity with veterans, what do you attribute them not wanting to go to government offices?
Well, the simplest thing is that I would say at least half of those people, so half of the 50%, 25%, just want nothing to do with the government. They don't trust the government. Their alienation level is still, even with Vietnam veterans I know and even World War II veterans, still so high, they would much rather get private health care or no health care at all than step across a line and enter into a relationship with the government that sent them to war.
John, thank you.
That's the simple truth.
John, thank you so much for the call and for the clarification. Jasper, how do you respond to, you know, what you're hearing when it comes to people not wanting to get government help because they don't trust the government?
Yeah. I think just to clarify that, I think that the caller was right that Matt didn't live in Williston. But it appears that he did. He's told me when I spoke to him, exit 12, Williston exit 79. That's where he set up maybe what was an early precursor to a vet center where he and Gail interviewed vets. So I believe that was in Williston. But, you know, one of the things that the VA has done is set up these vet centers, which are not, you know, openly branded as connected to the VA or, you know, the government necessarily. I think a lot of Vietnam vets who returned home really, you know, did not trust the government because the Vietnam War, frankly, was, you know, built on a lot of misleading information and the status of the war success was as well. And so I think a lot of vets just don't want any association with that. And the VA, in response, has created these vet centers that are supposed to be, you know, more community-based, less associated with the VA, but can still offer support for veterans who are willing and comfortable to get help. A lot of people also, you know, will go to the vet centers and then they can build up some trust in the VA if they, you know, secure good care, and then they can eventually, you know, become more involved in the system.
Let's go back to the phones and let's talk to Zach in Groton. Zach, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to comment a little bit on what Jasper spoke to earlier around, you know, just as a veteran and transitioning out of the military into civilian employment, you know, that there really is a misconception about veterans being broken and or wounded as a newly integrating civilian back into society. And some of that translates into, you know, trying to find some of the meaningful work that we do, and, you know, a lot of very big misunderstandings and misconceptions with things like, you know, how our job skills translate from our military service to civilian jobs. And, you know, and that's something that I definitely experienced coming out of active duty in 2012 as a captain. And being relegated to, you know, an hourly role in an organization because people didn't understand what my military service meant when it came to a job. And then the other part of it, too, is, you know, I think it ties into the broader sense of community that the military provides all of us as you know, as military, you know, serving in the military, but as part of that community, it's all often challenging to find that sense of community, both, you know, in the workplace and in your community when you leave active duty. And so I really feel like in Vermont, this has done pretty well. For me, in the Upper Valley, there are a lot of different parts of the community that are, you know, supportive and understanding of what it means to reintegrate into society as a veteran. And, you know, some of the outreach that's coming from the VA, both officially and unofficially, around the vet centers, but also things like something I'm participating in, which is a veterans book reading group where we're discussing these topics, you know, as a multi-generational veterans community on how we are reintegrating and how are we handling our transition, however long it takes into military service.
Zach, thank you so much for that call, and that was a wealth of information. And before the show goes on any longer, I just want to thank all of the veterans from around the state, and thank you for your service and everything you do. I'm sorry to not say that at the top of the show, but it's very much appreciated, everything you do. Now, Jasper, I want to switch gears a little bit and discuss politics and military service. In 2016, we know that 60% of veterans voted for former President Donald Trump. Was that also the case in 2020? And what do we know about where veterans traditionally align themselves?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, a caller earlier mentioned that I think a lot of people in the service really strictly adhere to a level of nonpartisanship that is incredibly important. Obviously, if the military becomes politicized, there are, you know, existential questions around democracy that accompany that trend. You know, the veteran population is generally self-identified as independent. However, it was really interesting in 2016 because then candidate Trump really engaged that population more than really any candidate in modern political history had. The Republican National Committee hired hundreds of organizers to go to, you know, Blue Angel air shows and, you know, VFW halls and really sort of speak to this community and listen to what they were hearing. And then Trump really sort of channeled a lot of those frustrations in what I think can be, you know, fairly stated to be cynical ways. But Trump, through his attention to veterans issues, actually won a historic slice of the veteran vote, significantly more than John McCain had in 2008. Obviously, McCain was a POW and decorated Vietnam War veteran. So you can see just how popular Trump was with this population. You know, I think the message, there were a number of messages that really resonated with veterans. I think one had to do with some of Trump's rhetoric around isolationism and, you know, bringing troops home after nearly two decades of forever wars. You know, he also did speak to frustrations that veterans had, you know, feeling isolated after coming home and struggling to get in the front door at the VA. And, you know, he passed a number of major laws in office focused on veterans issues, you know, these outsourced care, which has been a largely disastrous effort. He also passed legislation that took away key labor and organizing rights of VA employees, a third of whom are veterans. So the policies in practice have actually been pretty detrimental to the VA. But Trump was very much attuned to the issues, and Democrats largely have done very little to engage the population.
Now, you talk about there was an appreciation for Trump among many veterans, but there's also a unique Vermont connection to veterans who oppose Trump. Can you tell us about Dan Barkoff?
Yeah, sure. So Dan Barkoff is a doctor based in Burlington and a former Navy SEAL. And I think Barkoff and a number of other veterans saw the spike in support across their community for Trump and have really worked vigorously to oppose that trend. Barkoff has started a political group in which he organizes veterans to essentially oppose Trump and his allies, and also to you know, try and dissuade some veterans from falling into, you know, white supremacist and sort of, you know, intensely conservative movements, as was sort of exemplified in January 6th. I mean, tragically, there were an outsized number of veterans involved in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. Now, there were also veterans, you know, at as part of the Capitol Hill police force who were defending the Capitol. There were also vets in Congress like Adam Kinzinger who were, you know, helping their colleagues stay safe and sort of evade this mob. But, you know, I think the hard truth here is that veterans are a major target for white supremacist and hate groups in this country. And there was even a Department of Homeland Security report in 2009 that sketched out, you know, pretty deep ties between white supremacist groups and veterans. You know, they clearly want to use this population so that they can develop paramilitary skills and, you know, wreak pretty serious havoc.
I want to read an email before I go on to any more of my questions. This is from a woman who served in the Army for 11 years. And she writes, I experience sexual harassment on a daily basis. Yes, daily. I learned many other women had the same experience. Most of us were reluctant to report harassment or assault because of retaliation was a very real occurrence. The women were punished, but the men were not. When a woman in my unit was sexually assaulted during our workplace, she was punished by being transferred. The perpetrator was promoted. I live in the Upper Valley. I've been treated at the VA for 25 years, and my care is superior to the care I would have received anywhere else. I'm treated with respect. I hope that VA healthcare will not be privatized. What can you tell us about the privatization, and what does your book talk about the privatization of the VA healthcare?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, ever since that 2014 scandal we mentioned earlier in the show where Republicans, you know, parroted these misleading talking points about the VA being broken and having incredibly long wait lines and offering subpar care, there has been a movement pushed by healthcare companies largely who want veteran patients, who want to make money. And so what we've seen over the last decade or so is a number of pretty damaging policies, laws passed under Democratic and Republican presidents that have siphoned veterans out of the VA and into private sector hospitals. Again, you know, there are innumerable peer-reviewed studies that show the VA's healthcare is far superior to the private sector. There are issues, but unlike the private sector, those issues are publicized. There's a VA Office of Inspector General. There is a Government Accountability Office. There are House and Senate congressional committees that are constantly identifying problems and trying to fix them. It's an incredibly accountable system, and it delivers healthcare very well. It also specializes in the unique wounds of war, whether that's military sexual trauma or PTSD or traumatic brain injury. These are things that the private sector does not offer, but they see a patient population and they want in. So there has been an incredible amount of lobbying. There have been millions donated to lawmakers in charge of veterans' healthcare policy. And as a result, there have been a number of laws that have increasingly sent more veterans out to the private sector. At this point, roughly a third of the VA's care budget is going to private sector care. And I have spoken to countless veterans who have gone to the private sector and who, you know, aren't asked about their military service, who aren't asked if they were next to burn pits. You know, these doctors in the private sector just don't have the cultural competency to identify unique military issues and remedy them. Now, there's certainly a role that the private sector has long played. You know, if there's a specialist that the VA can't provide a veteran, they should go to that specialist, and that's long occurred. But what's happening now is all sorts of care is being sent out, and veterans are largely frustrated with the process.
I want to read another email from a listener in Brattleboro. She writes, I'm a mom of a current Vermont National Guard member. My dad is a World War II veteran. Our son has not had much need for VA services, but my dad is a disabled vet and has had extensive assistance with the VA. They are responsive and help my dad to and from appointments. He has told me repeatedly that the VA has been wonderful for him. And with this final minute, I want to ask, through all of your reporting and after writing this book, what does the phrase support our troops mean to you?
Well, I think what we need to do to support our troops is to understand them and to listen to them. You know, veterans are an increasingly rare breed. You know, they are confined largely to the South and Southwest. Military service is becoming a family business, and it's largely, you know, falling to families that are in economic need. They join the service out of a mix of patriotism and also need to get free college, to get a path to the middle class. And so what we need to do is really scrutinize the systems that they're living under, both the DOD and the VA, and try to improve them.
That's journalist and reporter Jasper Craven. Jasper, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Jasper Craven, co-author of the new book, Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. Jasper and his co-authors, Suzanne Gordon and Steve Early, will be attending a live event at the Burlington location of the Phoenix Books tonight at 7. There's a link for more information about that event on our website, vermontpublic.org.